Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Immigration reform was a major topic during U.S. President Donald Trump's first State of the Union address since he took office more than a year ago. He said for quite some time his administration has worked with both Democrats and Republicans on reforms.
Under our plan, those who meet education and work requirements and show good moral character will be able to become full citizens of the United States over a 12-year period. The second pillar fully secures the border.
And Congressman Joseph Kennedy, who provided the Democrats' response to the president's speech, criticized the president's wall proposal and sent a message to undocumented immigrants commonly referred to as dreamers.
Let me be absolutely clear. Ustedes son parte de nuestra historia. Vamos a luchar. Vamos a luchar por ustedes. Y no, nos vamos a alejar. You are part of our story. We will fight for you, and we will not walk away.
Also, the president revealed a new executive order during his State of the Union address. It cancels a 2009 order in which former President Barack Obama promised to close the Guantanamo Bay facility in Cuba. 16 years after the first prisoner arrived, 41 detainees remain at Guantanamo. Of the more than 700 prisoners who have been held there since 2002, only a handful have been charged with a crime and even fewer tried. Mr. Trump said during his campaign that he wanted to keep Guantanamo open and loaded up with bad dudes. The order preserves military detention as a counterterrorism tool by keeping the prison open. This is VOA News. A list of major Russian businessmen published by the U.S. Treasury Department doesn't mean the elite will be subjected to sanctions, but could foretell those most at risk if new sanctions arose. Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters reports.
A list of the Russian business elite drawn up by the Trump administration may foretell who would be targeted if Washington did levy new sanctions. The so-called oligarchs list includes names like the mining magnates Vladimir Potanin and Oleg Deripaska, seen here with their president Vladimir Putin last year. Shares in both their companies tumbled after the U.S. Treasury Department named them. It also includes the cybersecurity giant Eugene Kaspersky, whose software has been banned from federal computers for fear of backdoors to Russian spies. He hit back on Twitter, denying involvement with the government, and saying the list seems to have just been ripped from Forbes.
Afghanistan wants the U.S. government to stop deporting Afghan nationals, saying it has no repatriation agreement with the United States. And when VOA asked U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement if the United States has such an agreement, spokesman Brendan Rainey provided a written response saying international law obligates each country to accept the return of its nationals ordered removed from the United States. The United States itself routinely cooperates with foreign governments in documenting and accepting its citizens when asked, as do the majority of countries in the world. Pakistan has disclosed Tuesday it recently extradited 27 suspected Taliban and Haqqani militants to Afghanistan as part of an effort to stop insurgents from using Pakistan's soil for cross-border terrorist activities. Meanwhile, there have been numerous attacks that U.S. President Donald Trump has been very critical about.
In the past, the U.S. has not ruled out including the Taliban in possible peace talks. Asked why the Taliban is now claiming responsibility for the massacres, Michael Kugelman told VOA.
The Taliban wants to weaken the Afghan state in any way possible. And it wants to do that now by proving that the Afghan state cannot protect its people. It cannot protect security, and that includes civilians.
President Trump stepped up the U.S. military presence in the country with 11,000 American troops now stationed there, 16 years after the U.S. invaded the country following the September 11th terrorist attacks. Some experts say the terrorist attacks on civilians are being planned across the border in Pakistan.
That's Cindy Sain reporting for VOA. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Donald Trump has given his first State of the Union speech.
Since the election, we have created 2.4 million new jobs, including 200,000 new jobs in manufacturing alone.
We will have analysis of the president's speech as it relates to Africa. Raila Odinga promises to liberate Kenya after Tuesday's controversial swearing-in ceremony. Uganda's Speaker of Parliament warns justices not to interfere with the separation of powers. And Cameroon's separatist movement promises more violence after Nigeria hands over its leaders to the Cameroonian government.
We are not by any means demoralized by the situation we face. Rather, I will say, if we have ever been determined to free ourselves and free our country, the Southern Cameroon, it is now.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication for the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon, and the UN says a quarter of a million people in the Lake Chad Basin are in need of aid. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday night delivered his first State of the Union speech. As expected, Mr. Trump highlighted a strong economy during his first year in office.
Since the election, we have created 2.4 million new jobs, including 200,000 new jobs in manufacturing alone. After years and years of wage stagnation, we are finally seeing rising wages. Unemployment claims have hit a 45-year low. And something I'm very proud of, African-American unemployment stands at the lowest rate ever recorded. And Hispanic American unemployment has also reached the lowest levels in history. We enacted the biggest tax cuts and reforms in American history.
The televised speech before a joint session of Congress comes about a week after a three-day government shutdown spawned by a fight over the federal government budget and how to deal with hundreds of thousands of immigrants who years ago came to the United States illegally as children. President Trump called for a bipartisan action on immigration.
Over the next few weeks, the House and Senate will be voting on an immigration reform package. Here are the four pillars of our plan. The first pillar of our framework generously offers a path to citizenship for 1.8 million illegal immigrants who were brought here by their parents at a young age. Under our plan, those who meet education and work requirements and show good moral character will be able to become full citizens of the United States over a 12-year period. The second pillar fully secures the border. That means building a great wall on the southern border, and it means hiring more heroes like CJ to keep our communities safe. The third pillar ends the visa lottery, a program that randomly hands out green cards without any regard for skill, merit, or the safety of American people.
As U.S. President Donald Trump delivering his first State of the Union speech Tuesday night. Joining us now for analysis of the president's speech as it relates to Africa is J. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Washington-based Atlantic Council and the Director of its African Center. Good morning to you, Mr. Pham.
Thank you for having me, James.
You heard President Donald Trump delivering his first State of the Union speech. The African Union just completed its summit in Addis Ababa, and this came just after the president allegedly made his shitholes statement, allegedly referring to Africa. There was some reaction from Africa immediately after that, some people demanding an apology. I was reading that today that the president has sent a letter to the African Union. I wonder if you know about that, and what can you tell us?
Letter was a message to the African Union summit just recently completed, and he emphasized not only congratulations to those who had just served the outgoing head of the African Union, President Alpha Conde, but also congratulating President Paul Kagame, whom he met with just last week at the World Economic Forum. The president also emphasized the United States strongly respects partnerships and values partnerships with Africa, underscoring the economic relationship, but also the security relationship between the United States and Africa's countries. He highlighted some of the things that have occurred, including Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan's recent trips to Africa and the upcoming trip by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson planned for in 2 months' time.
So do you think now with this letter that this should be fine and put U.S.-Africa relations on the right track?
Well, I would argue that, you know, I can't speak to, there's been, you know, the president has said he did not say what he was alleged to have said. Others have said he said them. You know, I was not present. In fact, I was in Africa when that occurred. So I can't say what happened. But what I can say is that if you look at what this administration has done in its first year, it's been extraordinary. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson convened a ministerial meeting of African ministers from 36 African countries, something none of his predecessors had done, and did it within the first year of the administration. The National Security Strategy of the United States, which was released just before Christmas, for the first time in the nearly two decades that document has been mandated by U.S. law, the National Security Strategy for the first time had a separate section on Africa. And not only was it a separate section, but except for the section on the Indo-Pacific, it was the longest of the regional statements of policy of any region in the world. Africa got the longest statement except for the Indo-Pacific region. And it was a very detailed vision of the administration's strategy to Africa. So I would say, more broadly speaking, if you take in context of the one-year anniversary of the Trump presidency, this administration has not been perfect, but it has done a lot more than other administrations have done. Recall that the Obama administration did not release a U.S.-Africa strategy until 2012 in the midst of its reelection campaign.
We had a government shutdown, and there's one looming. The president laid out some immigration reforms. Do you think that is likely to bring everybody together to solve this problem?
Well, I think the president made the correct point that for legislation to pass, no one is going to get what he or she wants 100%. There has to be some compromise.
J.P. DeFarm is Vice President of the Washington-based Atlantic Council and the Director of its Africa Center. Cameroon's separatist movement is promising to unleash more violence after the Nigerian government handed over about 47 members of its leadership to the Cameroonian government. The leaders were abducted earlier this month by Nigerian security forces as they were holding a meeting in Abuja to discuss the welfare of Cameroon refugees in Nigeria. Nigeria handed them over to the Cameroonian authorities on Monday, and they were immediately jailed. The Ambazonian secessionist movement is seeking independence from French-speaking Cameroon. Chris Anu is Secretary of State for Communications for the Ambazonian Separatist Movement. He says the Nigerian government is complicit in a criminal act for sending what he called refugees back to Cameroon to be further persecuted.
Our reaction is that we are appalled and disappointed by Nigeria's action of transporting refugees and people running from political persecution to Cameroon. The only problem is we don't know who was transported or transferred to Cameroon, because we had 39 other refugees plus the 12 leaders. That would give you 51 people. The Cameroon government is only acknowledging 47, as you said, and so I'm wondering what happened to the other four. We are yet to know whether they are still in Nigeria or what happened to them. Are they dead? They are challenging the Nigerian government to step out and give us a report of what happened with our leaders in their custody. We want to know whether they are dead or alive.
The Cameroon Minister of Information, Issa Chiroma, is calling this a sign of cooperation between Cameroon and Nigeria, whereby none of the countries would allow their territory to be used by other groups to destabilize that country.
I do not consider that a sign of cooperation. It's a sign of criminal complicity, because you do not have two countries come together to carry out a criminal act. How can Nigeria send refugees back to be persecuted by a country that has allowed them? So there is nothing like cooperation between Cameroon and Nigeria. They are both accomplices to this act, and we will hold both of them responsible for it.
Mr. Anu, it must be demoralizing, the fact that your leaders, 46, 47 of them, have been arrested. What does this do to the movement?
We are not by any means demoralized by the situation we face. Rather, I will say the situation has poured fuel, gasoline, into a fire. If we have ever been determined to free ourselves and free our country, the Southern Cameroons, it is now. We are determined to take the fight to Yaounde and tell Yaounde, unless you arrest the 8 million of us, this fight will not be over. We are ready to face Yaounde with everything that we can until we live free or die.
I don't understand why you call those arrested refugees, when you call your movement a separatist movement, Ambazonia, why you say they are refugees.
You have a situation where we had some members of our interim government who are registered refugees in Nigeria, living in Nigeria, because the Cameroon government has proscribed our nationalist movements or organizations. So they had to run to live as refugees in Nigeria. That's why we call them refugees, even though they were our leaders. Now, you have also to understand that beside our leaders, we have close to 40,000 other refugees in Nigeria living under the auspices of UNHCR.
Chris Anu, Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonian Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Today is Wednesday, the 31st day of January, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The U.N. Refugee Agency announced on Wednesday that more than 250,000 people are in need of aid in the Lake Chad Basin region because of the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria. Since 2013, the insurgency has displaced more than 2.5 million people in northeast Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Liz Ahua, the UN Refugee Agency's West Africa representative, spoke to Ricky Stryak both about the urgent needs and long-term solutions.
The two major areas where we need support, of course, is food security, because we continue to provide food for those people who are living in the Sahel, where food is very, very difficult. We continue to need, obviously, resources to look after registration, which will put it under protection, and not just of the refugees, but also of the host community. Of course, the livelihoods, we want those people to become more independent, and being in exile now since 2014, and our aim is to try to find ways for them to fend for themselves and not continue to depend on the international community. It being understood that the situation in Nigeria may have improved in terms of capacity for some of the internally displaced people in Nigeria to go back, even under very difficult circumstances, it still is the case that we don't want them to become too dependent on aid.
You mentioned helping enable people to have their own livelihoods. Can you talk a little bit about those specific programs?
It varies from one country to the other. I must say that in terms of livelihood, the country where we see a lot of progress and we're actually quite happy is Niger. In Niger, We have projects. One of them is called the gas project, where we purchase gas and including the cylinders and give to the refugees. But we are winning them off that assistance because while we give them the cylinders, we don't have to give that to them twice. And they use the energy they have got to cook their food, but also some of them do some little trading. Either they are frying peanuts, little cereals for breakfast, which they sell, you know, things such as akara. Another means of livelihood, which actually goes more to the host community than to the refugee, but since they all have to interact with each other on the marketplace, is in the urban urbanization project, where we got government to allocate land. We distributed that land to the refugees and to the host community, as a result of which government got a little bit of money. And that is being used because they are located to the whole community at some cost. So the local community has been able to get money which they can inject into the community.
That was Liz Ahua, the West Africa representative for the UN Refugee Agency. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Niamey. Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga has promised to liberate Kenya following his controversial swearing-in ceremony on Tuesday. Speaking shortly after taking the oath, Raila said the event marks the end of electoral injustice in Kenya. Kenya's Interior Ministry has declared Mr. Odinga's opposition alliance, known as the National Resistance Movement, a criminal organization after Odinga symbolically took the oath of president in defiance of last year's controversial election and of authorities who said such an act would be considered treason. As viewers Daniel Schwab reports from Nairobi, it's not clear what comes next for Kenya given the political situation.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga was greeted by thousands of frenzied supporters at Nairobi's Uhuru Park Tuesday afternoon, despite a seven-hour delay. As the 73-year-old and his entourage drove through the crowd, his supporters jostled and some scuffled to see him inaugurated as the so-called People's President. After swearing an oath of office on a Bible, Odinga called it a historic day for the people of Kenya.
Today's step is one step towards being away with electoral autocracy and to establishing proper democracy in our country.
Meanwhile, the Interior Ministry wasted no time issuing a statement after the ceremony declaring Odinga's coalition, the National Resistance Movement, an organized criminal group under Kenya's Prevention of Organized Crimes Act. Odinga boycotted the rerun of last year's presidential runoff election and has refused to accept the victory of President Uhuru Kenyatta. Kenya's Attorney General said that Odinga declaring himself president would be considered an act of high treason, an offense punishable by death. President Kenyatta's office last week warned Odinga that any actions would be subject to Kenyan law. Although authorities used tear gas on supporters in an area near the event, an expected heavy police presence did not materialize. Opposition concerns that their leaders could be arrested before the event did not come to pass either.
That our people united can never be defeated.
Odinga briefly led the packed crowd in a chant, saying, "A people united can never be defeated," before slowly driving through the crowd and out of the park. Odinga's National Super Alliance contests the results of October's rerun election, which it boycotted after Kenya's Supreme Court took the rare step of annulling the August election due to failures by the Electoral Commission. Odinga says he won that August vote and accuses authorities loyal to President Kenyatta of covering it up. Election authorities have dismissed the claim, and the Supreme Court has backed Kenyatta's October win. Although there is no legal backing for Odinga's inauguration, many supporters, like Peter Musyoka, are optimistic. He says after the swearing-in, he is expecting their president to lead them and give them a way forward. He says he believes that Kenya will completely change, their democracy will change, and Kenyans will fully understand their rights. In an exclusive interview with VOA's Swahili service earlier in January, Odinga raised the possibility of forming a rival government, either inside or outside of Kenya. After Odinga's swearing-in Tuesday afternoon, he promptly changed his Twitter handle to President of the Republic of Kenya. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda's Speaker of Parliament says judicial courts should not interfere with the work of Parliament. Rebecca Kadaga says it is important for the three arms of government, the judiciary, executive, and legislature, to independently execute their work. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
Kadaga told Chief Justice Bart Katurebe at a function in Kampala this Monday that both the judicial and the parliament must give each other space if they are to effectively perform their duties.
The Speaker and the Chief of Parliament has no problem whatsoever in the judiciary examining the output of our work, examining the laws we have made. Absolutely no problem. But my lord, I have a problem with being directed how to carry out the responsibilities of the Speaker. My lord, a situation where a court directs a Speaker in session to close Parliament and come to attend court, I find that incredible. My lord, I cannot imagine a situation where a committee of my house, which has the powers of the High Court, can direct any single judge to stop work and come to attend a committee of Parliament. I don't think that would be possible.
At the heat of the Constitution Amendment debate, popularly known as age limit debate, some parliamentarians and members of the public sought court injunctions to halt the debate, although the Speaker, Rebecca Kadaga, reneged from attending the court. But Justice Katurebe says the courts of law have a duty to make checks on Parliament once they've been seized by any concerned parties. Katurebe says he expects anyone, once summoned, to honor court orders.
I want to reassure the Honourable Speaker that the judiciary has no intention whatsoever to interfere in the internal workings of Parliament, and we will not do so. However, if a citizen of this country chooses to move under Article 137 of the Constitution and comes before the Constitutional Court or any other court, then the judiciary has a duty to judiciously reconsider the allegations and make appropriate orders.
The officials were talking during the opening of new law year at the High Court premises in Kampala. The new law year, or legal year, is the calendar during which the judges sit in courts. Katurebe also says the judiciary is not adequately funded.
In the financial year 2016-17, the judiciary received 127.7 billion shillings. The funds appropriated to the judiciary were less than 50% of the funds the court asked for from the Minister of Finance. Less than 50%.
Consequently, he says the courts have a backlog of about 25% cases. Last year, there were strikes by judges and prosecutors who asked the government to increase their remunerations. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Cameroon's separatist movement is promising to unleash more violence after the Nigerian government handed over about 47 members of its leadership to the Cameroonian government. The leaders were abducted earlier this month by Nigerian security forces as they were holding a meeting in Abuja to discuss the welfare of Cameroon refugees in Nigeria. Nigeria handed them over to Cameroonian authorities on Monday, and they were immediately jailed. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication for the Ambazonian Separatist Movement, said the Nigerian government is complicit in a criminal act for sending back what he called refugees back to Cameroon to be further persecuted. Kenya opposition leader Raila Odinga has promised to liberate Kenya following his controversial swearing-in ceremony on Tuesday. Speaking shortly after taking the oath, Raila said the event marks the end of electoral injustice in Kenya. Kenya's Interior Ministry has declared Mr. Odinga's opposition alliance, known as the National Resistance Movement, a criminal organization. And that's it for this Wednesday, January 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of the VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Music time in Africa. Save it. savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.